But first, John Moe. Chances are pretty good that you're familiar with John Moe. He's had a long, illustrious career in public radio. He's hosted nationally distributed programs such as WITS, Weekend America, and Marketplace Tech. He's also the creator and host of the award-winning podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression. The podcast featured frank and powerful conversations with luminaries that covered all facets of depression and helped generate much-needed awareness. John has now written a companion book to the series called, wait for it, The Hilarious World of Depression. In it, he reveals his own personal struggles with the disorder.
I went through many decades just kind of getting by and putting up the front and fooling people and fooling myself. It was in my mid-30s when, owned a house, had a couple of kids, was married. My particular strain of depression really responds to stress. And as long as there isn't a lot of stress, it was sort of okay. But then, I had a career, I had a mortgage, I had a family, and I just started to kind of crack up a little bit. And my wife said, hey, I want you to go to the doctor because I think this might be a mental health thing. And I said, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm just, things are just stressful right now. And she said, well, you've been saying that for a couple years, and I think something's wrong. And why I didn't want to go, this will make no sense to people who haven't had depression and all the sense in the world to people who have. I didn't want to waste the doctor's time. I didn't want them to bother with me, even though that's why doctors exist, is to hear what's wrong with people. And I also didn't want to make the copay, which at the time was $10. I didn't think I was worth 10 bucks. And she said, well, fine. You don't love yourself enough to do this. Do you love me and the kids? And I said, yeah, more than anything. And she said, okay, great. Go do it for us. So I did. And I was diagnosed almost instantly. And it really changed my life.
Mm-hmm. What is it about us saddies that you think the normies, the people who don't have to deal with depression, what is it that they have the most trouble understanding?
That it's not a mood. I mean, depression is a word to describe a mood, but depression in the disorder sense is not a mood. I have a friend who lost her neighbor to suicide, and she said, well, I don't understand it because I talked to him 2 days before, and he seemed to be doing fine. And I'm like, yeah, because it's not like Morrissey. It's not like you're not moping. It's a mind that's out of whack. And so to that extent, it's not something you can cheer up from. But just like it's not a mood, you can't snap out of it, as my father used to say. And you can't go for a walk and then feel better. You can't smile more. You can't think of all the good things in your life. Because if that's all it took, we would have done that. Like, that's what's so aggravating about the normies is they'll say, well, why don't you just do this? Like, you think I haven't thought of that? It's no more effective than saying, just go for a walk and your leukemia will feel better. It's an illness.
Yeah. You say that even when you're in the darkest and most despairing times of your depression, you still find depression funny. What is it about depression that you find funny?
Well, I mean, I've been a comedy geek since I could understand words. I've always loved comedy in a really, really deeply connected way. So in one sense, it's just my way of understanding the world is to look for what's funny about it. But even when I'm at my worst, I see it as this sort of naughty, transgressive entity that is just, it's like a toddler behind the wheel of a car. It's a world out of balance. It's, the toddler is in tremendous danger and you should get him out of there. But it's funny. It's funny that it's this invisible thing in your mind that exists to tear you down. That it's such an unmotivated cruelty that it sort of makes me laugh.
You worked at Amazon during its early days. Did working there affect your depression?
Working there kind of helped me discover that something was truly wrong. We were all inventing our jobs at the time, and it was confusing, and there was a lot of power plays, and there was a lot of politics, and, there was bets on the future involved. I was there in the late 90s and very early 2000s. And so when I had massive deadlines approaching with a lot on the line, and I didn't have the tools to do my job because I was too busy figuring out what it was. That was one of my first instances of suicidal ideation, which was really surprising when it happened. I was on these tight deadlines. I was on the bus, I remember, through downtown Seattle. I lived in Seattle at the time. And I was thinking of all that I had to do. And this was before smartphones and smart tablets. So all I could do was sit on the bus and think about what I had to do. I couldn't do any of it. And I thought, well, why don't I just die? Why don't I just kill myself? That'll solve it. And it was such a out of the blue idea that I laughed at. I physically laughed out loud on the bus because I didn't want to do that. But it was like, oh, that's a thing. It was related to my stress peaking, which was cueing my depression to kick in. And it led to that thought. It wasn't that I was making a plan. It wasn't that I was in any danger, but there was like some wall that broke through and I'm like, oh no, well, I guess now that's on the table. It was terrifying. I left in 2001 for public radio where all my problems would be solved.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. As have all of mine been solved. Sure. Too, yeah. One of the toughest, if not the toughest things you've ever had to deal with in your life was the death of your older brother, Rick. Can you tell me about that?
Rick was my older brother by 6 years, and he had what would probably now be known as ADHD and dyslexia, and what was known then as being a bad kid or being a dumb kid. And that's what he was told, and that's what he believed. And he couldn't get along with school, you know, started working at 15, 16 years old, and school tapered off after that, and drugs tapered up, and he was a drug addict, moving from pot up to methamphetamine. And so it was, life was really hard for him. And there was a lot of depression that he didn't identify as depression. He thought, again, he was being dumb and bad and making bad decisions and was weak, when in fact he had an illness that nobody would ever choose. So he was in San Diego and he had cleaned up evidently and had been clean for several years and was working at a Narcotics Anonymous hotline. And at that hotline, he was convincing people that life was worth living and that they should stick around. He could never seem to believe that about himself. He went to a shooting range in San Diego, got a gun and shot himself. And so my life was, before that happened and after that happened, were the two parts of my life, really. That kind of got me going down this whole path to try to help other people not meet the same fate.
Yeah, well, and you experienced a lot of guilt over Rick's suicide. Why?
Well, I had written a book that came out in 2006, in the fall of 2006, and part of the book, I go to a shooting range outside Seattle. And I thought it was so funny that when I called them, they said, okay, well, you need to bring a friend. And I said, well, why is that? You either need to be a member here or you need to bring a friend, because people would just come down here, check out a gun and die right there at the shooting range. I thought that was just such a loose safeguard. Like, okay, well, then you become a member and then you come back. It was sort of more about how the looseness of gun control in America. And so that came out in October. Rick read the book around the holidays, joined a shooting range in February, and died in April of 2007. I have to choose my words carefully. I didn't kill him. He pulled the trigger himself. But I've always felt that I gave him a roadmap to it and a plan. It's something that if some other random reader had done the same thing, I'd be like, oh, that's terrible. They must have been in a really bad place. But because it was my brother, I knew that it was my fault that he died. And I've been to therapy treatments specifically aimed at that belief, and I'm doing pretty well. There's always going to be part of my brain that knows that I'm responsible for his death. And it's smaller than the part that says, of course I'm not, but it's always going to be there.
So it's been 13 years since Rick died. How are you doing in terms of coming to terms with his death?
Because my wife was very diligent, she identified a therapist right away who specializes in survivors of suicide. And that helped me tremendously, that somebody had that specific knowledge and I got to them. It helped me a lot. And the thing about grief is, you don't get over it. You go through it. And you're never the same. If you put it off and you try to just do other things instead, it'll just wait for you. It's been a long walk through it. You know, the big thing that I did, though, was at Rick's service in Seattle, all these family friends whose services he should have gone to one day were there, and they were coming up and consoling me in hushed tones and talking about how great Rick was on the camping trips that they remember him on when we were kids, and how he would tell a joke and you wouldn't even realize it was a joke for another hour. And, you know, he's always playing pranks that were harmless, but really intricate. And I said, well, yeah, that is what he was like when he was 11 or 12, but he became an addict after that. And he experienced homelessness, and he fought really hard against mental illnesses we didn't know he had. And he got treatment, and he was helping other people. There's a lot to Rick, and he didn't think he was worth saving, and he died because of it. And it's horrible. At that point, the family friend would say, okay, well, it was great seeing you. I'm going to go talk to anyone else right now. And it occurred to me just in that moment, I know the spot on the floor at the church where I had this thought of like, okay, let me get this straight. We could talk about it. You know, we could open up about mental illness, make it no different than saying I have a toothache or my back hurts and go get treatment and talk to therapists or family or general practitioners or clergy or support group, anybody. We could have more conversations, and there's a very good chance it'll get better for some people. Or we could have no conversations, and there's every likelihood it'll get worse. So what the hell are we doing? How is that even a choice? Why are we choosing as a society the one that kills people? That's stupid. And I had been in radio for a while at that point, and I thought, well, I talk. I have access to microphones. I could put a sentence together. Fine. I'll be the loudmouth. I'll defy my Norwegian upbringing and my suburban childhood. I'll just yell about it. I'll tell everybody about Rick and about myself and about, you know, I'll encourage people to talk to me about what's going on with them. And it's too late for Rick, but maybe it's not too late for somebody else. So I already know how to be a loudmouth. I'll just keep doing it.
And that was the whole motivation behind starting your podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, in 2016, right?
Yeah, some years later. I mean, I had been mostly a comedy guy. Even my attempts at straight reporting for a variety of public radio shows, there's always a bit of a comic bent to it. And so I've always kind of understood that world. But when I would write about depression, when I'd write about suicide and mental health awareness, even on Twitter, I would get these amazing responses, people saying, that does it. I'm going to make an appointment. I'm going to keep it this time, and I'm going to get help. Or, you know, I heard what you tweeted a month ago. I just came from my second session with my therapist, and it's going great. And I'm like, oh my gosh, the power of some tweets. And so I knew that I could talk on the subject, sure. But beyond that, that there was a hunger to talk about it, that people were ready for this movement to occur.
I'm Jeff Tweedy from the rock band Wilco.
I've read a lot about the migraines that you used to get.
I think that migraines were a way of making psychic pain visible to people around me that weren't able to see that there was real psychic pain. People that don't really experience it as a disorder tend to think, well, why can't you just not be sad, right?
Yeah.
So I think that throwing up 30 times in a row and being obviously in enormous pain.
So you felt like your body was converting all this psychic pain into an actual
something
migraine
that would be nurtured.
Yeah.
As opposed to being reacted to with, I'll give you something to cry about.
Right.
What is the most surprising thing you learned about your decades-long battle with depression while you were writing your book?
I think a lot of things have reasons, and that's vague, but what happened was I was a couple seasons into the show when I agreed to write the book, and I was really hesitant to write the book because I thought, well, who am I? Who cares what my experiences have been? My literary agent said, I think your story can help people, which was the button to push. And I said, okay, fine. And then there was a lot of people interested in publishing it, and it was great. In writing about that subject, I thought, well, if I'm going to write this subject, me, I better learn more about it. If you're going to write a book on something, you better be an expert. So I finally got to some good therapy. So I found a good therapist who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the therapy I use that I was really drawn to. And a lot of what that does is explores the cognitive distortions that depression and trauma create. So like thinking that, like magical thinking, where you think, well, it was a sunny day when I have to confront this thing, so it's going to be, this is going to go well. Or like, I'm nervous about what's going to happen and it's all going to fail because everything's always going to fail. And then when it doesn't fail, you don't think about that. You just think, oh, it's always going to fail. And these are all unrealistic, unverified, unscientific, and defenseless ways of looking at the world. And so what the therapy I went to really explored was, okay, why is this happening and how can we redirect it to more sensible, more workable thought patterns that are more in touch with the real world? And one of the ways that they do that is saying, okay, what are the things that are causing you agitation and where do these things come from? It's about knowing where you are and how you got there. I sometimes compare it to the difference between having a map of where you are, where you've come from, where you're going, versus just constantly waking up behind the wheel and trying to get somewhere.
John Moe, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Doug.
John Moe is the author of The Hilarious World of Depression and the host and creator of the podcast of the same name. Find out more about John and his work at wpr.org/beta.
They matter politically because they gave people the ability to critique the mainstream without having to go through college.
Sociologist Donna Gaines joins us to talk about her book, Why the Ramones Matter. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
People asking questions. Lost in confusion.